702. The Naked Scientist.
25 minutes to 3 o'clock, and we're taking your calls for The Naked Scientist. That's Professor Chris Smith, and he joins us, of course, via Skype from Cambridge in the UK. So your questions right now on 011-883-0702. How are you doing, Chris?
Yeah, I'm in good shape. How are you?
Very good, very good. We are day 53 of the national lockdown. So the counting continues.
Not that you're counting or anything.
Yeah, maybe it's got to stop at some point. But, you know, it helps to keep perspective somehow. It has that added benefit. So we're taking calls, as you well know. But I want to kick off with some of my own questions. I was just saying earlier that I was in a breathwork class all day Saturday. And someone shared something that I went on to also search and look for online. And I wanted your thoughts. And I thought, wow, I wonder what Chris knows about this, because we're gaining more understanding of this virus. And so the question really was about the infection of COVID-19 infection, whether it decreases in populations living at a high altitude. And I came across a little study. I couldn't look at all of it, but they were looking at, they were analyzing epidemiological data of COVID-19 of Tibet and high altitude regions in Bolivia and Ecuador. And they were comparing it with lowland data. And we have different numbers with where we are in Gauteng and, you know, different concerns and a different map with provinces that are along the coast, like KZN. I know you've been there, the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape. So it raised my, just piqued my curiosity about being at higher altitude and being able to tolerate carbon dioxide more.
I must admit, I've not read that particular study.
Okay.
I will need to go and review that. But just thinking about it more broadly, it's perfectly plausible there might be something in this. But at the same time, with this and very many other disorders, one has to be really cautious about something which is called confounding, which is where two things crop up together. You could spuriously draw some kind of conclusion that they are linked, but in fact they're independent of each other and just occurs by chance. A good way of thinking about this is, well, okay, let's compare people who live in lowland areas with people who live at the tops of mountains. Well, how many people live at the tops of mountains compared to the number of people living in high density where viruses spread really well at the bottom of the mountain in lowland areas? There are cities at the bottoms of the mountain. There are no cities at the top. The population density is therefore very different, and therefore the opportunities afforded to a virus to spread are very different. Yeah. The kinds of people, socioeconomically and otherwise, who live at the tops of mountains may be very different from people who live at the bottoms of mountains. Mm-hmm. You've got to be really careful before drawing a conclusion that something is a causal association. There may be another explanation to account for the association. Sure. So at this stage, I'll reserve judgment. I'll go and read the studies, and then I'll come back to you perhaps next week with some thoughts.
Perfect. And then there was another one that was in the Sunday papers, in fact, about the virus. On CNN, there was a story about how it's been found on shoes, and now some establishments are actually sanitizing people's shoes. And then locally, it was said that things like rings, if you wear rings, that it's found that sometimes you will have, not just with COVID-19, but that it can be, even if you wash your hands, the accessories that you wear on your hands can also be a place where different germs can kind of build or stay.
Spot on. And the real elephant in the room here is actually the device which outnumbers people on the planet and is almost ubiquitous. Pretty much every pocket on Earth these days has a mobile phone in it. And researchers are now realizing that in our drive, in order to use these devices to control the infection through things like apps, through things like paying contactless, actually what people are doing is using their phone, touching their phone with contaminated hands, and then putting their phone back in their pocket, diligently washing their hands, etc., going about their business very safely with, in some cases, face masks and eye protection. They get home, first thing they do, bring the phone out of their pocket and put it on their face.
Yeah.
when you're talking, you're spraying droplets all over the phone, which could contaminate the phone anyway if you've got an infection and then someone else touches it, or your hand touches it and picks up those droplets and infection. You then transmit them to a surface. So mobile phones are actually the lurking elephant in the room when it comes to things that are a breach in our infection control strategy. So researchers in Australia are cautioning people to be aware of this risk and to cleanse your mobile phone, wash your hands, wash your phone, they're saying, right, because it's a perfect surface for picking up germs. And so, yes, anything that you have contact with, you can put the virus onto them. In terms of shoes and that kind of stuff, yep, the virus can lurk in the environment for a period of time. And if you cough on your shoes or someone coughs on an area and you walk on it, you could have some virus on your shoes. The amount that's going to be there is going to be really low. The way in which it will get off your shoes and into you, very unlikely for that to happen. It can't infect you through your feet. And unless you go touching all over the shoes and then put your fingers in your mouth, really low risk. But, you know, another one of those things to be aware of, these viruses are pretty ubiquitous. They can get anywhere and everywhere. But if you wash your hands and then avoid touching your eyes, nose and mouth before you have washed your hands, you'll be in much better shape.
Awesome. Let's go to Jan. Hello, Jan.
Oh, thank you, Azania, for taking the call. Maybe it might be important. Hello, Dr. Chris. And my question is, are quantum computers being used in the search by the medical research teams all over the world to chop through this huge amount of data in a faster time and using the AI algorithm to find the answers to vaccines and antibodies, etc.?
Okay.
Jan, the answer to this one is that not quantum computers, because we haven't got lots of quantum computers that you can actually use in that sort of way yet. They're still very much at the experimental and developmental stage. But certainly people are using supercomputers to step through this data and analyze it. And they are definitely using artificial intelligence and machine learning to do that from a number of facets. One is looking at the trends in where the disease is, who's got it, how it's spreading, trying to find commonalities and spread patterns. So that's one way. Another way is to look for biomarkers. People are looking at the combinations of different chemicals and different markers that are in the bloodstream of people who have the infection, people who have the infection badly, and people who have the infection less badly to see if they can spot differences. That machine learning and AI type approach could be very valuable. And the other very important area is in the discovery or search for therapies. What people are doing are looking at various drugs and chemicals that we already have that we are using therapeutically, but for other things. And they're asking, do any of these look like they might make a difference when this virus with these sorts of structures on it, using these sorts of mechanisms in our cells, do any drugs interfere with those same sorts of targets or things that look like them? And they're using machine learning and AI to step through the chemical structures and the genetic changes provoked by these sorts of drugs in order to match them up with what the virus does to us in the hopes that we'll find matches and therefore potential therapies. So the answer is yes, but not with quantum computers, with all range of computers, including supercomputers.
All right. Jan, thank you so much for your question. Next, we have Jesper in Bryanston. Hi, Jesper.
Hi. I've got a question regarding milk. I buy full cream milk from two different suppliers. During here the COVID system, I have milk delivered. I freeze them. And when I thaw them, the one type, which is homogenized and pasteurized, thaws much faster than the other, which is homogenized but not, which is pasteurized but not homogenized. How can that be?
I assume that they're both identically packaged and the volumes of the liquids are identical, because otherwise it's not a fair test. But when you homogenize milk, what you're doing is they squirt the milk through a very fine sieve, which means that the particles of fat which are suspended in the liquid in milk, and those are where all the energy is that's going to go into the developing calf that the milk was intended for, it breaks up those droplets and makes them much smaller, so that then you end up with, instead of a layer of fat at the top and then watery stuff at the bottom, you've got this suspension of very tiny particles. Now, it may well be that because it's been treated in that way, you don't have this layer of fat at the bottom and water, sorry, fat at the top and water at the bottom. So it actually perhaps acts as a sort of almost like an antifreeze because you haven't got the separation in that way to stop the ice crystals forming this huge, great chunk of ice in there. It might be that it freezes but produces smaller ice crystals and that therefore it's easier for those to begin to melt and then for energy to pick its way through and melt everything more efficiently, more quickly. That might be why. It's my speculation. I don't know for sure. So if anyone knows the answer, tell me. But I think that's a pretty plausible answer.
Right. Yes, but thank you for your question. Okay. Thanks a lot. Next, we've got Keith in Malvern. Hello, Keith.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. And you?
Chris, maybe you can make an old man wiser, man.
I'll have a go.
Hello?
We can hear you. Go ahead, Keith. He's going to have a go.
Man, I've got a thing about you get an insect or any other thing just walking on a mirror or a glass without any suckers. How's that possible?
Ah.
Yeah. So how do things like flies mm-hmm. and other insects walk up and down windows and things? There's a number of ways they can do this. One is that flies have on the bottom of their feet tiny hairs and tiny little hooks. And if a surface is sufficiently rough, a fly will walk up the glass no problem because the glass surface has sufficient roughness because it's not a perfectly smooth pane that the little hooks and hairs on the fly's feet will actually engage with these toe holds on the glass and it can gain traction because a fly, especially a very small one, very, very light and therefore the amount of friction it needs to hold it on the window pane is very low. If you had a really, really smooth glass surface though, then the fly would not be able to walk up it. Oh. Some animals go a step further and they actually rely on electrostatic attraction to help them climb up implausibly smooth surfaces. Geckos, which are obviously much bigger and heavier than flies, do this with aplomb. And the way they do it is that they have lots and lots of tiny hairs, they're called setae, on their feet. And those setae, because they are tiny and very numerous, can get very close to the surface of the material that the animal is walking on. And there is a phenomenon called the van der Waal effect. And this is where, when you've got electrons orbiting around the nuclei of atoms, when you've got a big molecule, just from time to time by chance, the electrons spend further apart from one part of the molecule than another. And this makes one part of the molecule a bit charged compared to the other side of the molecule. And this means it can be potentially attractive to a surface. And by doing this a lot, you can get a tiny amount of attraction to summate into a very big attraction. And so geckos and similar animals can mm-hmm. stick to surfaces by using electrostatics to stick on, as well as gripping on as well, which gives them additional gripping power. So flies chiefly, it's because they're very light, they've got little hooks on their feet, and the glass that they're clinging onto is not perfectly smooth, so there are lots of little toe holes. The glass looks smooth to us, but it isn't, and that's how they grab onto it. Other animals use the power of electrical attraction to give them Spider-Man type abilities.
Nice. Keith, are you wiser?
oh yes.
Excellent.
Chris, you are a star and a gentleman. But I'm telling you,
Keith,
I won't be trying that on the glass myself then. I'm overweight.
People have done that,
too
Keith.
Heavy.
They've actually made the same sorts of inventions that actually the geckos use and done this with sticky tape and sticky surfaces that enable people to develop enormously strong forces to cling onto surfaces.
Oh.
They haven't got something yet, though, that works as well as Spider-Man can do it. But it's a hope and an aspiration for the future. But it certainly works well with things like Post-it notes.
Right. Keith, thank you very much. The Felicity has sent us a WhatsApp saying she saw you on Al Jazeera last night.
Mm. Oh, well, I'll have to have a word with Al Jazeera about that. They didn't pay me for repeats. No, I'm just kidding. No, we were talking about various things. I do occasional reports for them on television.
And then she wants to know, how can we start to fall over if standing with our eyes closed?
How do we start to fall over or how do we not fall over?
Well, she says, how do we start falling over or to fall over? So I think she's saying that we fall over or she finds that she probably doesn't stay up with her eyes closed.
Because this is quite an important test that a neurologist will do on a person. It's called Romberg's sign. And what you do is get a person to stand up with their feet together, and then you get them to shut their eyes. And if your nervous system is working properly, you have very good coordination between what your balance system is telling you is happening to you, which is in each of your ears. In your inner ear, you have the vestibular apparatus, which are a series of fluid-filled canals, which when you have any tiny movement of your head causes the distortion or movement or displacement of fine hairs which project into the liquid, and those fine hairs trigger nerve impulses which are then projected into your brainstem.
Yeah.
And the brainstem can therefore work out what way you're falling, and it sends impulses down your spinal cord to your various nerve muscle centers to turn on muscles which will oppose and balance out the falling. If something goes wrong with that system, you will begin to sway and fall over. And because you don't need your eyes when your system is working properly to stay standing up straight, you can close your eyes and stand up straight because you have the vestibular system there to work out what's happening. And you're also integrating all of the information coming up from your muscles, because muscles know how long they are and when they're being stretched or shortened. And that information is also being fed into the same parts of the brain to integrate and work out where your body is in three-dimensional space.
Yes.
And whether or not it's moving the way that you anticipate it's moving to stop yourself falling over. And that's how we do stand up without even having to look.
Right. And I find that the early days of doing yoga, sometimes you'd be encouraged to do this mountain pose. You know, you're standing upright with your eyes closed. And sometimes that would be difficult. But with time, it's something that has gotten easier. So in my experience, you can almost train yourself, or something improves, some other aspect improves.
Well, also, of course, if you do it a lot, then you're going to improve your muscle strength. And if you improve muscle strength and also the sensitivity to the signals coming back from your muscles, okay, then yes, you know, the humans are very trainable. We're very good at learning to become better at doing things.
Right.
But most people do this without even realizing it all the time, because as soon as you stand up and then read a book, if you're standing on a train reading a book,
yeah,
you're paying attention only to the book. You're not paying attention to what's going on around you. But despite the fact the train is moving, you're rocking, you might get jolted by the passengers when you're not socially distancing, of course, this helps you to stand up straight, and you're doing it all the time. This is, it's quite an impressive feat, actually, of neural engineering.
Yes, wow. Let's go to Bennett next in Benoni. Hello, Bennett.
Hello. How are you, Azania?
Good, how are you?
All right, thank you. And your guest also. I just want to ask, what makes the mosquito inactive during winter when it's cold? Because of yesterday, I had this weird thing whereby my room was flooded with mosquitoes, but they never bite me like in summer when it's hot. What makes the mosquito to be so like inactive during winter or when it's cold?
Even if you've seen it, like you've seen it, but they just haven't done the usual summer
exactly
nonsense.
In my room, I could see them on the ceiling, but now I slept the whole night. I never got bitten whatsoever.
Right.
You're a lucky man, Bennett, I'll tell you. That I know many who would envy you not being bitten by all these mosquitoes. Some people are much more attractive. The answer is that mosquitoes don't have the same metabolism all year round. They can actually hibernate, and during the winter season, the mosquito metabolism will switch down and they spend a lot less time being active. When the summer comes, they increase their metabolism and they shift their metabolism, especially if they're a female mosquito, towards being able to digest protein. And because they are in mating season, because they mate in summer, because they need to lay their eggs in water, they need a high protein diet. And so they bite in summer. And that's why when they sense that the temperature has risen, they increase their metabolic rate, they shift their metabolism to be away from just digesting sugars, to become very good at digesting protein, and then they come and feast on you. And it'll be just the female mosquitoes, because they need the protein they get from a blood meal in order to churn out the millions of eggs that the mosquito population lay in all of the water that they can find to make baby mosquitoes.
Oh, wow. Thanks for that question, Bennett. For the longest time, I thought they only lived a season.
No, mosquitoes can hibernate. They can make it through the winter. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Right. It is extraordinary. Bennett, there's your answer.
That was amazing.
Thank you.
Okay,
they're your friend only in winter, not in summer. That's Bennett and Benoni. Wonderful question. And then we've got Mandy. Mandy, you're going to have to turn your radio off. Yes,
good afternoon,
Azza.
How are you?
Fine. How are you, Mandy?
I'm very well, thank you. Good afternoon to the Naked Scientist. I just wanted to find out, yes. I'm asking for a friend, what causes the gum to move away from their original place, and then you find that after eating, the food gets stuck on the teeth, as if you even brush your teeth. And is there a way of reversing this?
Okay. Chris?
The line broke up a tiny bit. Could you just summarize Mandy's question for me, please?
Okay, so what Mandy is asking, she says, what makes the gums start to move away from the teeth? You know, with the years, then food gets stuck because those gaps now start to appear between the teeth. And how do you get them to go back?
Hello, Mandy. This is a phenomenon called recession. And most people think of the word recession as being something to do with finances. But actually, it's in the case of in your mouth, it's the gums retreating back up the tooth. And normally, there's a close relationship between the gum and the tooth. And it's there to protect you from the ingress of microorganisms. And if you clean your teeth carefully, you can brush away dental plaque and the buildup of other microorganisms and calculus, which is the hard stuff that microbes deposit on the tooth surface. And this keeps the gums healthy. If you don't clean that stuff away, or you don't floss between your teeth properly and regularly, then what happens is that you get low-grade inflammation in the gum line caused by oral organisms. And this is called gingivitis. The gingival margin is where the gum meets the tooth. And if you have chronic gingivitis, this is what leads to the recession of the gums. So it's all down really to good quality oral hygiene, regular brushing and flossing. And there's an old saying that dentists use, which is if you don't have to floss all your teeth, just the ones you want to keep. Because if you do get chronic recession of your gums and gum disease like this, it will eventually lead to the tooth loosening and potentially tooth loss. But there's another impact, which is that this same gingivitis and chronic gum disease is also linked to heart disease. People who have poor oral hygiene have a higher risk of having a heart attack and stroke. And the reason is that they have higher levels of baseline inflammation in the body. And if you have higher levels of inflammation, this also has a knock-on effect in your blood vessels and increases the risk of arterial disease. So it's a good idea to have a healthy mouth and you'll have a healthy blood supply as well.
Wow. Oh, and it also leads to sensitivity, brushing, so it's uncomfortable.
It can do, yes. And unfortunately, very, very difficult when it's very bad. When you've got damage there already, it's very, very difficult to get it to reverse.
So,
and that was the other part of Mandy's question, which is how do I make it go away?
Yes.
Regrettably, although there is some grounds for recovery, if you've got very severe gum recession, it's really difficult to get that back. And so most of the aim of this is to make sure you don't let it get any worse. So adopt good oral hygiene practices from now, and that will stop it getting worse. But unfortunately, you can't wind back the clock and completely reverse all of the damage that's already been done, which is why it's important to try to stop it getting worse right away.
Yes, one of those things in life. Okay, just like that, I feel like we had just started our conversation and now we're done and we're out of time.
It's gone so quick. It always flies, doesn't it?
It did. It absolutely did today. Chris, thank you so much. I've got to take a break in the headlines. We'll see you again on Monday.
Bye, Azza.
Yes, that's how we start our week and that's how we end the show. And that's with the Naked Scientist every Monday just after 2:30. Don't miss your shot to ask him a science-related question.